was not yet 15, and even when I was a little fellow, I used to wonder how she could live at peace with him and be always kind and good.
"Kind and good is Morgause indeed," said Morgaine. "Nor had she any very easy life with Lot. He may have sought her counsel in all things, but the court was so full of his bastards he had no need to hire men-at-arms, and any woman who came into the court was his lawful prey, even I, who was his wife's niece. Such behaviour is thought manly in a king, and if any criticise it in Morgause, I will have a word to say to them myself."
Gawain said, "I know well you are my mother's friend, Morgaine. I know, too, Guinevere doesn't like her. Guinevere..."
He glanced at Lancelot, shrugged, and held his peace. Gareth said,
"Guinevere is so pious, and no woman has ever had anything to complain about at Arthur's court. Perhaps Guinevere finds it hard to understand that a woman may have cause for wanting more of life than her marriage gives her.
As for me, I'm fortunate that Leonore's chose me of her own free will, and she's always so busy breeding or lying in or suckling our youngest that she has no leisure to look at any other man, even if she would.
Which," he added, smiling, "I hope she has no desire to do. For if she wished for it, I think I could deny her nothing."
Lancelot's face lost its grimness.
He said, "I cannot imagine that a dame married to you, Gareth, would wish to look elsewhere." "But you must look elsewhere, cousin," said Gawain, "for there is the queen looking for you, and you should go and pay your respects as her champion."
And indeed, at that moment, one of Guinevere's little maidens came and said in her childish voice,
"You are Sir Lancelot, are you not? The queen has asked that you will come and speak with her."
And Lancelot bowed to Morgaine and said, "We will speak later, Gawain, Gareth," and went away. Gareth watched him, frowning, and muttered, "Ever he runs when she stretches out her hand." "Did you expect anything else, brother?" Gawain said in his easy-going way. "He has been her champion since she was wedded to Arthur. And if it were otherwise, well, so Morgaine said. Such things are considered manly in a king. Why should we criticise them in a queen? Nay, 'tis all the fashion now. Or have you not heard the tales about yonder Irish queen married to old Duke Marcus, and how Drustan makes songs for her and follows her about? He is a harper, they say, as fine as Kevin. Have you yet heard him play, Morgaine?"
She shook her head. She said, "You shouldn't call Isotta a queen of Cornwall.
There is no queen in Cornwall but I. Marcus reigns there only as my castellan, and if he does not know it, it is time he found it out. I do not think Isotta cares what Marcus may call himself," said Gawain, turning to look at the long table where the ladies sat.
Morgause had joined Guinevere and the Irish queen, and Lancelot had come to speak with them. Guinevere was smiling at Lancelot, and Morgause making some jest which made them laugh. But Isotta of Cornwall was staring at nothing, her exquisite face pale and drawn.
"I never saw any lady who looked so unhappy as yonder Irish queen."
Morgaine said, "If I were married to old Duke Marcus, I doubt I should be happy."
And Gawain gave her a rough hug.
"Arthur did not well when he married you to that grandsire old Urien's either, Morgaine. Are you unhappy too?"
Morgaine felt her throat tighten, as if Gawain's kindness would make her weep.
"Perhaps there isn't much happiness for women in marriage after all."
"I wouldn't say that," Gareth said. "Leonor seems happy enough."
"Ah, but Leonore's is married to you," Morgaine said, laughing, "and I couldn't have that good fortune. I am only your old cousin."
"Still," said Gawain, "I criticise not my mother. She was good to Lot all his life long, and while he lived she never flaunted her lovers in his face. I begrudge her nothing,
and Lamorak is a good man and a good knight. As for Guinevere, he grimaced, it's God's pity that Lancelot didn't take her away from this kingdom while there was still time for Arthur to find him another wife. Still, I suppose young Galahad will be a good king in his day. Lancelot is of the old royal line of Avalon, and royal, too, in his blood from Ban of Less Britain.
Still, said Gareth, I think your son closer to the throne than his, Morgaine. And she remembered that he had been old enough to remember Gwydion's birth.
And the tribes would give allegiance to Arthur's sister. In the old days, the sister's son was the natural heir, in the days when rule passed through the blood of the woman.
He frowned and thought for a moment, then asked,
Morgaine, is he Lancelot's son?
She supposed the question was natural enough. They had been friends from childhood. But she shook her head, trying to make a jest instead of showing the irritation she felt.
No, Gareth. If it had been so, I would have told you. It would have pleased you so, anything to do with Lancelot. Forgive me, cousins. I should go and speak with your mother. She was always good to me.
She turned away, making her way slowly toward the dais where the ladies sat. The room was growing more and more crowded as everyone greeted old friends, and little knots of people collected. She had always disliked crowded places, and she had lately spent so much time on the green Welsh hills that she was no longer used to the smell of bodies crowded together and the smoke from the half-fire. Moving to one side, she collided with a man who staggered under her light weight and caught at the wall to steady himself. And she found herself face to face with the Merlin. She had not spoken with Kevin since the day of Vivian's death. She looked him coldly in the face and turned away.
Morgaine.
She ignored him. Kevin said, in a voice as cold as her glance,
Will a daughter of Avalon turn her face away when the Merlin speaks?
Morgaine drew a long breath and said, If you bid me hear you in the name of Avalon, I am here to listen. But that suits you not, you who gave Vivian's body to Christian rule. That I call a traitor's deed.
And who are you to speak of traitor's deeds, lady, who sits as queen in Wales when Vivian's high seat is empty in Avalon?
She flared. I sought once to speak in Avalon's name, and you bade me hold my peace. And bowed her head, not waiting for his reply. No, he is right.
How dare I speak of treachery when I fled from Avalon, too young and too foolish to know what Vivian planned?
Only now do I begin to know that she gave me a hold on the king's conscience. And I cast it aside, unused, and let Guinevere lead him into the hands of the priests. Speak, Merlin. Avalon's daughter listens. For a moment he said nothing, but only looked at her, and she remembered, sorrowfully, the years when he had been her only friend and ally at this court. At last he said,
Your beauty, like Vivian's, ripens with the years, Morgaine. Next to you, every woman at this court, including that Irish woman they call so beautiful, is a painted doll.
She smiled faintly and said, You did not stop me in my tracks with the thunders of Avalon to make me pretty compliments, Kevin.
Did I not? I spoke ill, Morgaine. You are needed in Avalon. She who sits there now is...
He broke off, troubled.
Are you so much in love with your elderly husband that you cannot tear yourself away?
No, she said. But I do the work of the goddess there too.
This much I know, he said, and so I have told Ninian. And if Accolon can succeed his father, the worship of the goddess will grow there. But Accolon isn't his father's heir, and the older son is a priest-ridden fool.
Accolon is not king, but druid, Morgaine said, and Avaloch's death would avail nothing,
They follow Roman ways in Wales now, and Avaloch has a son.
Con, she thought, who sat in my lap and called me Granny.
And Kevin said, as if he had heard her unspoken words,
"The lives of children are uncertain, Morgaine. Many come not to manhood."
"I will do no murder," she said, "even for Avalon, and you may tell them so for me."
"Tell them yourself," said Kevin. "Ninian said to me that you would be coming there after Pentecost."
And now Morgaine felt the empty, cold sickness strike at her stomach, and was glad she had eaten but little of the rich food of the feast.
"Do they know all, then? Do they watch, judging me, as I betray my old and trusting husband with Accolon?"
She thought of Elaine, trembling and shamed in the light of the torches that had caught her naked in Lancelot's arms. "Do they know even what I plan, before I am certain of it myself?" But she had done only what the goddess gave her to do.
"What is it that you came to tell me, Merlin?"
"Only that your place in Avalon is empty still, and Ninian knows it as well as I. I love you well, Morgaine, and I am no traitor. It pains me that you think me so, when you have given me so much."
He held out his twisted hands.
"Peace, then, Morgaine, between us."
She said, "In the lady's name, peace, then," and kissed his scarred mouth.
"For him, too, the goddess wears my face."
And pain struck through her.
"The goddess is the giver of life and manhood,
and of death." As her lips touched his, the Merlin recoiled, and on his face was naked fear.
"Do you recoil from me, Kevin? I swear it on my life, I will do no murder."
"You have nothing to fear," she said.
But he put out his twisted fingers to stop the words. "Make no oath, Morgaine, lest you pay the penalty of the forsworn. None of us knows what the goddess may demand of us. I, too, have made the great marriage, and my life was forfeit on that day. I live only at the will of the goddess, and my life is not so sweet that I would begrudge to lay it down," he said.
Years later, Morgaine would remember these words, and feel them sweeten the bitterest task of her life. He bent to her, in the salute given only to the Lady of Avalon, or to the High Druid, and then, swiftly, turned away. Morgaine stood trembling, watching him go. Why had he done that? And why did he fear her? She moved on through the crowds. When she reached the dais, Guinevere gave her a chilly smile, but Morgause rose and took her into an ample, warm embrace.
"Dearest child, you look tired. I know you have little love for crowds."
She held a silver cup to Morgaine's lips, and Morgaine sipped the wine, then shook her head. She said,
"You seem to grow ever younger, aunt."
Morgause laughed gaily and said, "Young company does that for me, my dear. Saw you, Lamorack. While he thinks me beautiful, I think myself so. And so I am. It is the only sorcery I need."
She traced with her smooth finger a little line beneath Morgaine's eye and said,
"I recommend it to you, my dear, or you will grow old and cross."
"Are there no handsome young men at Urien's court with an eye for their queen?"
Over her shoulder, Morgaine saw Guinevere's frown of distaste, even though she certainly believed Morgause was joking.
"At least the tale of my behaviour with Accolon isn't common gossip here."
Then she thought angrily,
"In the lady's name, I'm not ashamed of what I do. I'm not Guinevere."
Lancelot was talking with Isotta of Cornwall.
Yes, he would always have an eye for the most beautiful woman in the room.
And Morgaine could tell Guinevere liked it not. Guinevere said now, with nervous haste,
"Lady Isotta, know you my husband's sister, Morgaine?"
The Irish beauty raised her eyes listlessly to Morgaine and smiled.
She was very pale, her chiselled features white as new cream, her eyes that blue that is almost green. Morgaine saw that although she was tall, her bones were so small that she looked like a child hung with jewels and pearls and golden chains, which seemed too heavy for her. Morgaine had sudden pity for the girl, and withheld the first words that came into her mind, which were, "So they call you Queen in Cornwall now. I must have words with Duke Marcus." She said only, "My kinsman told me you are skilled in herbs and medicines, lady. Some day, if we have leisure before I return to Wales, I would like to speak of them with you."
"It would be a pleasure," said Isotta courteously.
Lancelot looked up and said, "I have told her also that you are a musician, Morgaine. Are we to hear you play this day?"
"With Kevin here?"
"My music is nothing to his," said Morgaine.
But Guinevere shuddered and interrupted.
"I wish Arthur would listen to me and send that man from his court. I like it not to have wizards and sorcerers here, and such an evil face must portend evil within. I know not how you can bear to touch him, Morgaine. I should think any fastidious woman would be ill if he touched her. Yet you embraced and kissed him as if he were a kinsman."
"Clearly," said Morgaine, "I am altogether lacking in proper feelings, and I rejoice at it."
Isotta of Cornwall said in her soft, sweet voice, "If what is without is like to that which is within, then the music Kevin makes must be a sign to us, Lady Guinevere, that the soul within him is indeed that of the highest angels, for no evil man could play as he plays."
Arthur had come to join them, and had heard the last few words. He said, "Yet I will not affront my queen with the presence of one distasteful to her. Nor will I have the insolence to command the music of such an artist as Kevin for one who cannot receive him with grace."
He sounded displeased.
"Morgaine, will you play for us then?"
"My harp is in Wales," she said.
"Perhaps if someone can lend me a harp, at another time."
"The hall is so crowded and noisy, the music would be lost.
Lancelot is as much a musician as I."
Lancelot, standing behind him, shook his head.
"Oh, no, cousin, I know one string from another, because I was reared in Avalon, and my mother set a harp in my hand for a plaything as soon as I could hold one. But I haven't the gift of music as Morgaine has, nor the nephew of Marcus. Have you heard Drewston play, Morgaine?"
She shook her head, and Isotta said, "I will ask him to come and play for us." She sent a page for him, and Drewston came, a slight young man, dark-eyed and dark-haired. He was indeed, Morgaine thought, not unlike Lancelot. Isotta asked him to play, and he called for his harp, and sat on the steps of the dais, playing some Breton tunes. They were plaintive and sad, in a very old scale, and they made Morgaine think of the ancient land of Lyonnais, far away and sunk past the coastline of Tintagel. He had indeed a gift beyond Lancelot's, even, she thought, beyond her own. Though he wasn't Kevin, nor near to it, he was the finest player otherwise that she had heard. His voice, too, was sweet and musical. Under cover of the music, Arthur said softly to Morgaine,
"How is it with you, sister? It is long since you came to Camelot. We have missed you."
"Oh, indeed," said Morgaine. "I thought that was why you married me away into North Wales, that my lady," an ironic bow to Guinevere, "might not be affronted with the sight of anything distasteful to her, neither Kevin nor me."
"Why, how can you say that?" demanded Arthur. "I love you well, you know that, and Urien's is a good man, and he seems to dote on you. Certainly he hangs on your every word." "I sought to find you a kind husband, Morgaine, one who had sons, and wouldn't reproach you should you not give him children. And it was my pleasure this day to make your fine young stepson one of my companions. What could you ask more than this, my sister?
What indeed? Said Morgaine.
What more could a woman desire than a good husband, old enough to be her grandsire, and a kingdom to rule at the far end of the world? I should bow down and thank you on my knees, my brother.
Arthur sought to take her hand.
Indeed, I did what I thought would please you, sister. Uriens is too old for you, but he will not live for ever. Truly, I thought it would make you happy.
No doubt, thought Morgaine, he was telling the exact truth as he saw it. How could he be so good and wise a king and have so little imagination? Or was this the secret of his kingship, that he held to simple truths and sought for no more? Was this why the Christian faith had lured him, that it was so simple, with a few simple laws?
I like that everybody be happy, Arthur said.
And she knew that this was really the key to his nature. He did indeed seek to see everyone happy, down to the least of his subjects. He had allowed what went on between Guinevere and Lancelot, because he knew it would make his queen unhappy if he parted them. Nor would he hurt Guinevere by taking another wife, or a mistress to give him the son she could not.
He is not ruthless enough to be High King, she thought,
while she tried to listen to Drustan's sorrowful songs. Arthur turned to speaking of the lead and tin mines of Cornwall. She should ride to see them. Duke Marcus should know that he was not ruler over all that country, and, no doubt, she and Isotta would be friends. They both cared for music. See how intently she listened to Drustan.
It isn't love of music which makes it impossible to take her eyes from him, Morgaine thought, but she didn't say so.
She considered the four queens who sat at this table, and sighed. Isotta could not take her eyes from Drustan, and who could blame her? Duke Marcus was old and stern, with quick, darting, ill-natured eyes that reminded her of Lot of Orkney. Morgause had beckoned to her young Lamorack, and was whispering to him. Well, who could blame her? She had been wedded to Lot, and he was no prize, when she was but 14. And all the while Lot lived, she had been mindful of his pride, and never flaunted her young lovers in his face. And I am no better than any of them, cosseting Uriens with one hand, and slipping away to Accolon's bed with the other, and justifying myself by calling Accolon my priest. She wondered if any woman ever did otherwise. Guinevere was High Queen, and she had first taken a lover, and it seemed to Morgaine that her heart hardened like stone. She and Morgause and Isotta were married to old men, and such was their life. But Guinevere had been married to a man who was handsome, and no more than her own age, and High King as well. What had she to be discontented with? Drustan put the harp aside, bowing, and took up a horn of wine to cool his throat.
I can sing no more, he said, but if the Lady Morgaine would like to take my harp, she is welcome. I have heard of the lady's skill as a musician.
Yes, sing for us, child, said Morgause.
And Arthur added his entreaty.
Yes, it is long since I heard your voice, and it is still the sweetest voice I have ever heard.
Perhaps because it is the first voice I remember hearing, Arthur said. I think you sang me to sleep with lullabies before I could talk plain,
and you were no more than a child yourself.
Always I remember you best like that, Morgaine, he added. And before the pain in his eyes, Morgaine bent her head.
Is this what Guinevere cannot forgive, that I bear for him the face of the goddess?
She took Drustan's harp and bent her head over the strings, touching them one by one.
"'Tis tuned differently than mine, she said, trying a few strings, and then looked up as there was a commotion in the lower hall. A trumpet blew, harsh and shrill, inside the walls, and there was a tramp of armed feet. Arthur half rose, then sank back into his seat, as four armed men, bearing sword and shield, strode into the hall. Kai came to meet them, protesting. It wasn't allowed to bear weapons into the king's hall at Pentecost. They shoved him roughly to one side. The men wore Roman helmets. Morgaine had seen one or two of those preserved in Avalon, and short military tunics, and Roman armour, and thick red military cloaks streamed out behind them. Morgaine blinked. It was as if Roman legionaries had walked out of the past. One man bore, at the end of a pike, the carved and gilded figure of an eagle.
"Arthur, Duke of Britain!" cried out one of the men. "We bear you a message from Lucius, Emperor of Rome!"
Arthur rose from his seat and took a single step toward the men in legionary dress.
"I am not Duke of Britain, but High King," he said mildly, "and I know of no Emperor Lucius. Rome has fallen, and is in the hands of barbarians, and, I doubt not, impostors. Still, one does not hang the dog for the impertinence of the master. You may say your message." "I am Castor, centurion of the Valeria Victrix Legion," said the man who had spoken before. "In Gaul the legions have been formed again behind the banner of Lucius Valerius, Emperor of Rome. The message of Lucius is this: that you, Arthur, Duke of Britain, may continue to rule under that style and designation, provided that you send him within 6 weeks imperial tribute consisting of 40 ounces of gold, 2 dozens of the British pearls, and 3 wagon loads each of iron, tin, and lead from your country, with 100 ells of woven British wool and 100 slaves.
Lancelot rose from his place, leapt forward into the space before the king. "My lord Arthur," he cried, "let me flay these impudent dogs and send them yelping back to their master. And tell this idiot Lucius that if he wants tribute from England, he may come and try to take it."
"Wait, Lancelot," said Arthur gently, smiling at his friend. "That is not the way."
He surveyed the legionaries for a moment. Castor had half-drawn his sword, and Arthur said grimly,
"No steel may be drawn on this holy day in my court, soldier. I do not expect a barbarian from Gaul to know the manners of a civilized country. But if you put not your sword back into its sheath, then, I swear, Lancelot may come and take it from you as best he can. And no doubt you have heard of Sir Lancelot even in Gaul. But I want no bloodshed at the foot of my throne."
Castor, baring his teeth with rage, thrust his sword back into his sheath.
"I'm not afraid of your knight Lancelot," he said. "His days were long gone in the wars with the Saxons. But I was sent as a messenger with orders to shed no blood. What answer may I take to the Emperor, Duke Arthur?"
"None, if you refuse me my proper title in my own hall," said Arthur.
"But say this to Lucius: that Uther Pendragon succeeded Ambrosius Aurelianus when there were no Romans to aid us in our death struggle against the Saxons. And I, Arthur, succeeded my father Uther. And my nephew Galahad will succeed me on the throne of Britain. There is none who can lawfully lay claim to the purple of the Emperor. The Roman Empire rules no more in Britain. If Lucius wishes to rule in his native Gaul, and the people there accept him as king, I will surely not come to contest his claim. But if he lays claim to a single inch of Britain, or less Britain, then he shall have nothing from us but 3 dozen good British arrowheads, where they will do him most good."
Castor, pale with fury, he said,
"My emperor foresaw some such impudent answer as this. And this is what he bade me say: that Les Britain is already in his hands, and he has imprisoned King Ban's son Bors in his own castle. And when the Emperor Lucius has laid all of Les Britain waste, then he will come to Britain, as did the Emperor Claudius of old, and conquer that country again, in despite of all your painted savage chiefs smeared with woad." "Tell your emperor," said Arthur,
that my offer of 3 dozen British arrowheads holds good. Only now will I raise my offer to 300, and he gets no tribute from me but one of them through his heart. Tell him, too, that if he harms a single hair on the head of my companion Sir Bors, I shall give him to Lancelot and Lionel, who are Bors' brothers, to skin him alive and hang his flayed corpse from the castle walls. Now go back to your emperor and give him that message. No, Kai, don't let anyone lay a hand on him. A messenger is sacred to his gods.
There was an appalled silence as the legionaries strode out of the hall, turning crisply on their heels and letting their mailed boots stamp and ring on the stones. When they had gone, a clamour arose, but Arthur raised his hand and quiet fell again.
"There will be no mock battles on the morrow, for we will have real ones soon," he said. "And for prizes, I can offer the plunder of this self-styled emperor. Companions, I would have you ready to ride at daybreak for the coast. Kai, you can handle the provisioning. Lancelot,"
a faint smile as he looked at his friend,
"I would leave you here to guard the queen, but since your brother is prisoned, I know you will wish to ride with us. I shall ask the priest to say holy service for those of you who wish to be shriven of any sins before you ride into battle tomorrow at dawn. Sir Uwaine,"
his eyes sought out his newest companion where he sat among the younger knights,
"now I can offer you glory in battle instead of war games. I beg you, as my sister's son, to ride at my side and cover my back against treachery."
"I am honoured, my king," Owain stammered, his face glowing.
And in that moment, Morgaine saw something of how Arthur had inspired such great devotion.
"Uriens, my good brother-in-law," said Arthur, "I leave the queen in your care. Remain at Camelot, and guard her till I return."
He bent to kiss Guinevere's hand.
"My lady, I beg you to excuse us from further feasting. There is war upon us again."
Guinevere was white as her shift. "And you know it is welcome to you, my lord. God keep you, dear husband." And she leaned forward to kiss him. He rose and went down from the dais, beckoning.
"Gawain, Lionel, Gareth, all of you! Companions, attend me."
Lancelot delayed for a moment before following him. "Bid me also God's blessing as I ride, my queen."
"O God, Lancelot,"
Guinevere said, and regardless of the eyes on her, she flung herself into his arms. He held her, gently, speaking so softly that Morgaine couldn't hear, but Morgaine saw that she was weeping.
But when she raised her head, her face was dry and tearless.
"God speed you, my dearest love."
"And God keep you, love of my heart,"
Lancelot said very softly.
"Whether I return or no, may he bless you."
He turned to Morgaine.
"Now indeed do I rejoice that you are to pay a visit to Elaine. You must bear my greetings to my dear wife, and tell her I have gone with Arthur to the rescue of my kinsman Bors from this knave who calls himself the Emperor Lucius. Tell her I pray God to keep her and care for her, and send my love to our children."
He stood for a moment silent, and for a moment Morgaine thought he would kiss her too. Instead, smiling, he laid his hand against her cheek.
"God bless you too, Morgaine, whether or no you want his blessing."
He turned to join Arthur where the companions were gathering in the lower hall.
Uriens came to the dais and bowed to Guinevere. "I am at your service, my lady."
"If she laughs at the old man," Morgaine thought with a sudden fierce protectiveness, "I will slap her." Uriens meant well, and the duty was no more than ceremonial, a minor tribute to kinship. Camelot would be very well in the hands of Kai and Lucan, as always.
but Guinevere was accustomed to diplomacy at court. She said gravely,
"I thank you, Sir Uriens.
You are most welcome here. Morgaine is my dear friend and sister, and I will be happy to have her near me at court again."
"Oh, Guinevere, Guinevere, what a liar you are."
Morgaine said sweetly, "But I must ride forth and visit my kinswoman Elaine. Lancelot charged me to bear his news."
"You are always kind," said Uriens, "and since the war is not in our countryside, but across the channel, you shall go when you wish. I would ask Accolon to escort you, but it is likely he must ride with Arthur to the coast."
"He really would leave me in Accolon's care. He thinks good of everyone," Morgaine thought, and kissed her husband with real warmth. "When I have paid my visit to Elaine, my lord, may I have leave to visit my kinswoman in Avalon?"
"You may do your own will, my lady," said Uriens. "But before you go, will you unpack my things? My valet can never do it so well as you. And will you leave some of your herbal salves and medicines for me?"
"To be sure," she said. And as she went to make all ready for her journey, she thought with resignation that no doubt, before they parted, he would want to sleep with her this night. Well, she had endured it before this. She could do so again. What a whore I have grown. Chapter 12. Morgaine knew that she dared make this journey only if she made it one step at a time, one league at a time, one day at a time. Her first step, then, was to Pellinore's castle. Bitter irony that her first mission was a kindly message to Lancelot's wife and his children. All that first day she followed the old Roman road northward through rolling hills. Kevin had offered to escort her, and she had been tempted. The old fear gripped her that she wouldn't find her way to Avalon this time either, not dare to summon the Avalon barge, that she would wander again into the fairy country and be lost there for ever. She had not dared go after Vivian's death. But now she must meet this test as when she had first been made priestess, cast out of Avalon alone, with no test save this, that she must be able somehow to return. By her own strength, not Kevin's, she must win entry there again. Still she was frightened. It had been so long. On the fourth day she came within sight of Pellinore's castle, and at noon of that day, riding along the marshy shores of the lake, which now bore no trace of the dragon which once had lurked there, though her serving man and woman shivered and clung together and told each other horrible tales of dragons, she caught sight of the somewhat smaller dwelling which Pellinore had given to Elaine and Lancelot when they were wedded. It was more villa than castle. In these days of peace, there weren't many fortified places in that countryside. Broad lawns sloped down toward the road, and as Morgaine rode up toward the house, a flock of geese sent up a great squawk. A well-dressed chamberlain greeted her, asking her name and business. "I am the Lady Morgaine, wife of King Uriens of North Wales. I bear a message from the Lord Lancelot." She was taken to a room where she could wash and refresh herself, then conducted to the great hall where a fire burned, and wheat cakes were set before her, with honey and a flask of good wine. Morgaine found herself yawning at the ceremoniousness of this. She was, after all, a kinswoman, not a state visitor. After a time, a small boy peered into the room, and when he saw that she was alone, came in. He was fair, with blue eyes and a splashing of golden freckles on his face, and she knew at once whose son he was, though he was nothing like his father.
"Are you the Lady Morgaine, that they call Morgaine of the Fairies?"
Morgaine said, "I am. And I am your cousin, Galahad."
"How do you know my name?" he asked suspiciously. "Are you a sorceress? Why do they call you Morgaine of the Fairies?"
She said, "Because I am of the old royal line of Avalon, and fostered there. "'And I know your name not from sorcery, "'but because you look like your mother, "'who is also my kinswoman.'
"'My father's name is Galahad, too,' said the child, "'but the Saxons call him Elfaro.
"'I came here to bear your father's greetings to you, "'and to your mother, and to your sisters, too,' Morgaine said.
"'Nimue is a silly girl,' said Galahad. "'She's a big girl, 5 years old. "'But she cried when my father came "'and wouldn't let him pick her up and kiss her "'because she didn't recognize him. "'Do you know my father?'
"'Indeed I do,' said Morgaine. "'His mother, the Lady of the Lake, "'was my foster mother and my aunt.' "'He looked sceptical and frowned.
"'My mother told me that the Lady of the Lake "'is an evil sorceress.'
"'Your mother is—' Morgaine stopped and softened the words. "'He was, after all, only a child. "'Your mother didn't know the lady as I did. "'She was a good and wise woman and a great priestess.'
"'Oh?'
"'She could see Galahad struggling with this concept.
"'Father Griffin says that only men can be priests, "'because men are made in God's image, and women are not.' "'Nimue said she wanted to be a priest when she grew up "'and learn to read and write and play upon the harp. "'And Father Griffin told her that no woman could do all these things, "'or any of them.'
"'Then Father Griffin is mistaken,' said Morgaine, "'for I can do them all and more.'
"'I don't believe you,'
Galahad said, "'surveying her with a level stare of hostility.
"'You think everyone is wrong but you, don't you?' My mother says that little ones shouldn't contradict grown-ups, and you look as if you weren't so much older than I. You aren't much bigger, are you?
Morgaine laughed at the angry child and said, But I am older than either your mother or your father, Galahad, even though I'm not very big. There was a stir at the door, and Elaine came in. She had grown softer, her body rounded, her breasts sagging. After all, Morgaine told herself, she had borne 3 children, and one was still at the breast. But she was still lovely, her golden hair shining as bright as ever, and she embraced Morgaine as if they had met but yesterday.
"'I see you have met my good son,' she said. "'Nimue is in her room being punished. She was impertinent to Father Griffin. And Gwenny, thank heaven, is asleep. She's a fussy baby.' "'and I was awake with her much of the night. "'Have you come from Camelot? "'Why did my lord not ride with you, Morgaine?'
"'I've come to tell you about that,' Morgaine said. "'Lancelot will not ride home for some while. "'There is war in Les Britain, "'and his brother Bors is besieged in his castle. "'All of Arthur's companions have gone to rescue him "'and put down the man who would be emperor.' "'Elaine's eyes filled with tears, "'but young Galahad's face was eager with excitement.
"'If I were older,' he said, "'I would be one of the companions, "'and my father would make me a knight, "'and I would ride with them, "'and I would fight these old Saxons, "'and any old emperor too.'
"'Elaine heard the story and said,
"'This Lucius sounds to me like a madman.'
"'Mad or sane, he has an army "'and claims it in the name of Rome.' Morgaine said. "'Lancelot sent me to see you, and bade me kiss his children. "'Though I doubt not, this young man is too big to be kissed like a babe,' she said, smiling at Galahad. "'My stepson, Uwain, thought himself too big for that when he was about your size, "'and a few days ago he was made one of Arthur's companions.'
"'How old is he?'
asked Galahad. "'And when Morgaine said 15, he scowled furiously.' "'And began to reckon up on his fingers. "'Elaine asked, "'How looked my dear lord? "'Galahad, run away to your tutor. "'I want to speak with my cousin.' "'And when the child had gone, she said, "'I had more time to speak with Lancelot before Pentecost "'than in all the years of our marriage. "'This is the first time in all these years "'that I have had more than a week of his company.'
"'At least he didn't leave you with child this time,' said Morgaine.
"'No,' said Elaine. "'And he was very considerate, "'and didn't seek my bed during those last weeks "'while we waited together for Gwen's birth. "'He said that I was so big it would be no pleasure to me. I wouldn't have refused him. But to tell the truth, I think he cared not at all.
And there's a confession for you, Morgaine. You forget, said Morgaine with a grim little smile. I've known Lancelot all my life.
Tell me, Elaine said. I swore once I would never ask you this. Was Lancelot your lover? Did you ever lie with him?
Morgaine looked at her drawn face and said gently, No, Elaine. There was a time when I thought, but it came never to that. I did not love him, nor did he love me.
And to her own surprise, she knew the words were true, though she had never known it before.
Elaine stared at the floor, where a patch of sunlight came in through an old discoloured bit of glass that had been there since Roman days.
Morgaine, while he was at Pentecost, did he see the Queen?
Since Lancelot is not blind, and since she sat on the dais beside Arthur, I suppose he did, Morgaine said dryly.
Elaine made an impatient movement. You know what I speak of.
Is she still so jealous? Does she hate Guinevere so much?
She has Lancelot. She has borne his children. She knows he is honourable. What more does she want?
But before the younger woman's nervously twisting hands, the tears which seemed to hang on her eyelashes, Morgaine softened.
Elaine, he spoke with the Queen, and he kissed her in farewell when the call to arms came.
But I vow to you, he spoke as courtier to his Queen, not as lover to lover. They have known one another since they were young, and if they cannot forget that once they loved in a way that comes not twice to any man or woman, why should you begrudge them that?
You are his wife, Elaine, and I could tell when he bade me bear you his message. He loves you well. And I swore to be content with no more, did I not?
Elaine lowered her head for a long moment, and Morgaine saw her blinking furiously. But she didn't cry, and at last she raised her head.
You, who have had so many lovers, have you ever known what it is to love?
For a moment, Morgaine felt herself swept by the old tempest, the madness of love which had flung her and Lancelot on a sun-flooded hill in Avalon into each other's arms, which had brought them together again and again, until it all ended in bitterness. By main she forced away the memory, and filled her mind with the thought of Accolon, who had roused again the sweetness of womanhood in her heart and body when she had felt old, dead, abandoned, who had brought her back to the goddess, who had made her again into a priestess. She felt bands of crimson rising in quick successive waves over her face. Slowly she nodded. Yes, child, I have known. I know what it is to love. She could see that Elaine wanted to ask 100 other questions, and she thought how happy it would be to share all this with the one woman who had been her friend since she left Avalon, whose marriage she had made. But no. Secrecy was a part of the power of a priestess, and to speak of what she and Accolon had known would be to bring it outside of the magical realm, make her no more than a discontented wife sneaking to the bed of her stepson. She said, But now, Elaine, there is something more to speak of.
Remember, you made me a vow once, that if I helped you to win Lancelot, you would give me what I asked of you. Nimue is past 5 years old, old enough for fostering. I ride tomorrow for Avalon. You must make her ready to accompany me. No.
It was a long cry, almost a shriek.
No, no, Morgaine, you cannot mean it.
Morgaine had been afraid of this. Now she made her voice distant and hard. Elaine, you have sworn it.
How could I swear for a child not yet born? I knew not what it meant. Oh, no, not my daughter, not my daughter. You cannot take her from me, not so young.
Again Morgaine said, You have sworn it.
And if I refuse?
Elaine looked like a spitting cat, ready to defend her kittens against a large and angry dog.
"If you refuse," Morgaine's voice was as quiet as ever, "when Lancelot comes home, he shall hear from me how this marriage was made, how you wept and begged me to put a spell on him so that he would turn from Guinevere to you. He thinks you the innocent victim of my magic, Elaine, and blames me, not you. Shall he know the truth?"
"You would not."
Elaine was white with horror. "Try me," Morgaine said. "I know not how Christians regard an oath, but I assure you, among those who worship the goddess, it is taken in all seriousness. And so I took yours. I waited till you had another daughter, but Nimue is mine by your pledged word."
But what of her? She is a Christian child.
How can I send her from a mother into a world of pagan sorceries?"
"I am, after all, her kinswoman," Morgaine said gently.
"How long have you known me, Elaine? Have you ever known me do anything so dishonourable or wicked that you would hesitate to entrust a child to me?"
"I do not, after all, want her for feeding to a dragon. And the days are long, long past, when even criminals were burnt on altars of sacrifice."
"What will befall her, then, in Avalon?"
asked Elaine so fearfully that Morgaine wondered if Elaine, after all, had harboured some such notions.
"She will be a priestess, trained in all the wisdom of Avalon," said Morgaine. "One day she will read the stars and know all the wisdom of the world and the heavens." She found herself smiling. "Galahad told me that she wished to learn to read and write and to play the harp. And in Avalon, no one will forbid her this. Her life will be less harsh than if you put her to school in some nunnery. We will surely ask less of her in the way of fasting and penance before she is grown."
But what shall I say to Lancelot?"
wavered Elaine.
"What you will," said Morgaine. "It would be best to tell him the truth, that you sent her to fosterage in Avalon, that she might fill the place left empty there. But I care not whether you perjure yourself to him. You may tell him that she was drowned in the lake, or taken by the ghost of old Pelennor's dragon, for all I care."
"And what of the priest?"
"When Father Griffin hears that I have sent my daughter to become a sorceress in the heathen lands..." "I care even less what you tell him," Morgaine said. "If you choose to tell him that you put your soul in pawn for my sorceries to win yourself a husband, and pledged your first daughter in return..."
"No,
I thought not."
"You are hard, Morgaine,"
said Elaine, tears falling from her eyes.
"Cannot I have a few days to prepare her to go from me, to pack such things as she will need?"
"She needs not much," said Morgaine. "A change of shift, if you will, and warm things for riding, a thick cloak and stout shoes, no more than that. In Avalon they will give her the dress of a novice priestess. Believe me," she added kindly, "she will be treated with love and reverence as the granddaughter of the greatest of priestesses. And they will...
what is it your priests say?
They will temper the wind to the shorn lamb. She will not be forced to austerities until she is of an age to endure them. I think she will be happy there."
"Happy? In that place of evil sorcery?"
Morgaine said, and the utter conviction of her words struck Elaine's heart. "I vow to you, I was happy in Avalon. And every day since I left, I have longed, early and late, to return thither. Have you ever heard me lie? Come, let me see the child."
"I bade her stay in her room and spin in solitude till sunset.
She was rude to the priest, and is being punished," said Elaine.
"But I remit the punishment," said Morgaine. "I am now her guardian and foster mother, and there is no longer any reason to show courtesy to that priest. Take me to her."
They rode forth the next day at dawn. Nimue had wept at parting with her mother, but even before they were gone an hour, she had begun to peer forth curiously at Morgaine from under the hood of her cloak. She was tall for her age, less like Lancelot's mother, Vivian, than like Morgause or Igraine. Fair-haired, but with enough copper in the golden strands that Morgaine thought her hair would be red when she was older. And her eyes were almost the colour of the small wood violets which grew by the brooks. They had had only a little wine and water before setting out, so Morgaine asked, "Are you hungry, Nimue? We can stop and break our fast as soon as we find a clearing, if you wish."
"Yes, Aunt."
"Very well." And soon she dismounted and lifted the little girl from her pony.
"I have to."
The child cast down her eyes and squirmed. "If you have to pass water, go behind that tree with the serving woman," said Morgaine, "and never be ashamed again to speak of what God has made."
"Father Griffin says it's not modest."
"And never speak to me again of anything Father Griffin said to you," Morgaine said gently, but with a hint of iron behind the mild words. "That is past, Nimue." When the child came back, she said with a wide-eyed look of wonder,
"I saw someone very small peering out at me from behind a tree. Galahad said you were called Morgaine of the Fairies. Was it a fairy, Aunt?"
Morgaine shook her head and said, "No, it was one of the old people of the hills. They are as real as you or I. It is better not to speak of them, Nimue, or take any notice. They are very shy, and afraid of men who live in villages and farms."
"Where do they live, then?"
"In the hills and forests," Morgaine said. "They cannot bear to see the earth, who is their mother, raped by the plough and forced to bear, and they do not live in villages."
"If they do not plough and reap, Aunt, what do they eat?"
"Only such things as the earth gives them of her free will," said Morgaine. "Root, berry and herb, fruit and seeds. Meat they taste only at the great festivals. As I told you, it's better not to speak of them. But you may leave them some bread at the edge of the clearing. There is plenty for us all." She broke off a piece of a loaf and let Nimue take it to the edge of the woods. Elaine had, indeed, given them enough food for 10 days' ride, instead of the brief journey to Avalon. She ate little herself, but she let the child have all she wanted and spread honey herself on Nimue's bread. Time enough to train her, and after all, she was still growing very fast.
"You are eating no meat, Aunt," said Nimue. "Is it a fast day?"
Morgaine suddenly remembered how she had questioned Vivian. "No, I do not often eat it."
"Don't you like it?"
"I do."
"Well, eat it then, if you wish. The priestesses don't have meat very often, but it isn't forbidden. Certainly not to a child your age."
"Are they like the nuns? Do they fast all the time? Father Griffin says..."
She stopped, remembering she had been told not to quote what he said. And Morgaine was pleased. The child learned quickly. She said, "I meant you are not to take what he says as a guide for your own conduct. But you may tell me what he says, and one day you will learn to separate for yourself what is right in what he says and what is folly, or worse."
"He says that men and women must fast for their sins. Is that why?"
Morgaine shook her head. "The people of Avalon fast, sometimes to teach their bodies to do what they are told without making demands it is inconvenient to satisfy. There are times when one must do without food or water or sleep, and the body must be the servant of the mind, not the master. The mind cannot be set on holy things or wisdom or stilled for the long meditation which opens the mind to other realms when the body cries out, 'Feed me,' or 'I thirst.' So we teach ourselves to still its clamouring. Do you understand?"
Not really,
said the child doubtfully. "You will understand when you are older, then.
For now, eat your bread, and make ready to ride again.
Nimue finished her bread and honey, and wiped her hands tidily.